My name is Ray Choate. I'm the university librarian at the University of Adelaide, and one of our libraries is on this campus. It's a new building over in the far corner, adjacent really to the Herbray Gardens and the Herbray House. And if you have time after this meeting tonight, the talk tonight, the library was probably not open tonight, but the gardens will still be very attractive. And if you haven't seen the Herbray Gardens, it's an opportunity while you're here just to have a quick stroll around. Mr. Seedlins, the Latvian landscape gardener, did quite a few of the gardens there, and he's a prize-winning landscape architect. And also, you will notice from the veranda of Herbray House the fantastic views of the city that you also get from this place. The first thing I have to remind you is if you have a mobile phone, would you please switch it off, and I better make sure my own is off. Rabina and I have always tried to work out something where she could ring me when I'm talking, and then I could be embarrassed. Mine is off. That's good. Now, the other thing before I need to give apologies from our president, Professor Chris Burrell, who couldn't be here this evening, but this evening we also have some special unannounced guests. Part of the success of the Friends functions like this is our sponsors. And you've all enjoyed this evening, as I have, one or more glasses, and I'm not counting, of Coriol Wines. And I would like to introduce Mark Lloyd from Coriol Wines. Mark, stand. And quite a few of his staff are here, and we really seriously do appreciate wine sponsorship, particularly when it's good wine. So thank you, Mark and staff. See you in the future, I hope. Now, I'd like to ask the secretary, honorary secretary of the Friends of the Library, to do the introduction, Rabina Weir. And this is a funny thing. It seems to go loud and soft.
Good evening, everybody. It's wonderful to see you out at Waite. And the Friends of the Library, and this year, have tried to do a variety of events. And this is one of the extra ones. And We don't just look at the literature that we keep in the library, but we look at the science and the humanitarian and books and, that we have. And so we decided that this would be an excellent event this evening, particularly as we had somebody, Patrick, who was willing to come and talk. Now, Patrick has an association with Waite and Roseworthy. He was an associate... excuse me, I've got to read this. He's now a visiting research fellow, and he has been a senior lecturer here. And his topic, of course, is wine, and that's why we've got Why Do Wines Taste Like They Do? I hope after the virtual tasting, we'll all know that. But it really is a pleasure to see so many people here, because we normally have our events in the Bar Smith. And so thank you for all those people who have come from the city out to here, and the people who are in this and who live out here, to take advantage of having an event here. So Patrick has been teaching and researching about grapes and wines for about 30 years, and he runs a publishing company. Now, you will have seen out the back some of the books, and they are only two of the many books that his company publishes. And I hope afterwards you'll be able to go out there, and some of you may want to purchase some. I understand that they're widely used in wineries and teaching facilities throughout Australia. And so Patrick is very well known. Now, Patrick is the co-author of some of these books, as well as the author. And he, when we were discussing, or through our president, Chris Burrell, when we were discussing what we'd be doing tonight, Patrick suggested we do this virtual tasting. I don't know what that means. I think most of us like to taste it, but I think he's going to let us know what we should, while we're tasting, what we should be, what the ingredients and the smells and all that. So he's going to lead us through that. So I'd like to welcome and introduce. It'll take a minute for me to get this off of me onto him. So while it's that, just look at the board.
Thank you very much, Rabina, and welcome to the Waite. I'll tell you a little bit about the Waite later in the lecture. But tonight we're going to taste some wines virtually. We're going to have an introduction to climate change and how it's affecting the life of the grapevine. And then we'll talk a little bit about the mysterious world of biodynamics. And then we'll finish with a very special Australian wine to end the night. So for tonight's virtual tasting, we have three wines, a champagne, a dry red, and a fortified. Now, we've already set them up in front of you, but please don't try them until I ask you to taste the wines. Just be careful with your hands, but it doesn't matter if you do knock them over because it's all virtual. So why do wines taste like they do? They taste like they do because of what's in them, the components that give you that sensory experience when you taste a wine. And the four main sensory components are the aroma, sweetness, acidity, and astringency. These four elements, along with what we call body, whether the wine is light, medium, or full-bodied, make up what I call the flavour shape of a wine. It's the experience of the wine in the mouth. So the flavour shape of champagne, because we're going to be tasting a champagne, it's light-bodied, doesn't have a lot of intense aroma, not a lot of sweetness in the main champagne styles. It's driven by acidity, and the acidity drives the shape to the right. And that acidity provides freshness and vitality and length to the palate. When we make a champagne, or when the people in Champagne make a champagne, they take grapes, and the grapes are mainly Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, and Pinot Meunier, and they take them from different vineyards, and all the vineyards are classified according to their quality, and they make their base wine like a normal wine. Then you blend all those base wines. In Champagne, there may be 30 to 100 base wines that go into a blend. Then you add some sugar and yeast, mix it, and then distribute it into individual bottles. The secondary fermentation occurs in that bottle. The yeast convert the sugar to alcohol and carbon dioxide, and that's the bubbles that you have in champagne. And then, and this is the point that I want to talk about tonight, is those wines are then stored on yeast lees in the cellars for a varying period of time, anywhere from a year to 20 years. And then the wine is bottled, it disgorged from the yeast lees and bottled in that bottle, and you have your champagne. In champagne, the wines, the bottles, are stored in these chalk cellars built by the Romans a couple of thousand years ago. While the wine is in those bottles, after the secondary fermentation, the yeast cells die, and then they go through a process. They go through a process of yeast autolysis. And during that process, the yeast cells break down and they release compounds into the wine. And these compounds can give you nutty, doughy, bready, biscuity types of characters. Also, the normal aging processes are going on, and you can get honeyed and toasty characters intermingled with these other yeast autolysis characters. So this shows you the bottle of wine with the yeast cells now lying on the bottom, and the process of yeast autolysis and aging that I've just described occurs there for however long those bottles are kept in the cellars. The first wine that we're going to taste is named after the monk who's claimed to have invented champagne, but That isn't really true, but that's a story for another time. And so the first wine that you're going to have is Dom Perignon, and it's 1996 Enotec, a top vintage year, and this is a prestige wine of Moët Chandon. So because it was virtual, wasn't restricted by any cost factors. So this bottle cost $600 a bottle. So I'd like you to taste the wine now, and you can see before you taste it, the most obvious feature is that fine bead of bubbles going up to form the mousse on top of the surface of the wine. But when you smell this wine, you'll experience some aromas of honeyed, some nutty characters. But it's when you put it in your mouth that you really experience a complexity. The complexity that comes with long aging on yeast lees. This wine has been in those cellars for 15 years on yeast lees. So we're expecting a lot of complexity. So when you taste this wine, you will have experience not only the bready, biscuity, nutty characters that come from yeast autolysis, but you'll have honeyed and toasty characters all intermingled there. It'll be a very complex sensation, an enjoyable sensation. You will also experience a lovely, creamy texture, because the other thing that happens during yeast autolysis is the compounds that are released from the yeast cells, they produce aminoproteins and monosaccharides, or polysaccharides, that give you a textural sensation in the mouth. So you get this lovely creamy sensation, textural sensation. But you also experience the length of this wine because of the high acidity that was there in the grapes when the grapes were picked. So this vibrant acidity will drive the wine right through your palate and give you a lovely, refreshing sensation to finish that taste of that champagne. I'll just take a moment to talk about one of our books, The Taste of the World of Wine. Myself and Peter Dago, Andrew Kaylard and Peter Dry are the authors. Myself and Peter Dry were lecturers at Roseworthy Agricultural College before we moved down to the Waite. And we spent about 20 years here teaching at the Waite, and both of us are still actively involved as visiting research fellows. Peter Gago is the senior winemaker at Penfolds and custodian of Grange, our most famous red wine. And Andrew Kaylard is an MW. So we all have a Roseworthy or an Adelaide University connection, either being on the staff or having been students. But I also need to mention Judith, my wife. We write at these books, and it's quite a task to write with four authors. And myself and Judith put the similar style together. These guys, Peter and Andrew Kaylard, they taste wines from all around the world. So we take their notes and their experiences and put it together. Peter Dry and I tend to provide the academic input. Once we've done that, Judith types it, formats it, organises the printing, markets it, and sells it. So pretty well she does everything for after we've written it. So how does the flavour shape of a dry red wine differ to champagne? It mainly differs because of the component astringency. Astringency is that puckering, drying sensation that you get when you taste red wines. It comes from the tannins that are in the skin and the seeds of the grape. Also, the dry red wine will be a much fuller bodied wine, so the shape changes. Briefly, how do we make a dry red wine? Well, because all the flavour and the colour are in the skins, you need to keep those skins in contact with the juice, the fermenting juice. And Penfolds have a technique called rack and return, where they take off all the liquid and the skins drop down, and then they pump the liquid back over the skins. This provides a gentle but thorough extraction of the flavour compounds. You can either finish the fermentation in oak barrels, or in many cases, after the fermentation is finished, the wines are stored in oak barrels, and this gives you further taste sensations, as does, after you've bottled the wine, the ageing process. So the wine that we have to taste tonight is Penfolds 2004 Kalymna Block 42 Cabernet Sauvignon. Kalymna Vineyard is in the Barossa Valley, and it's quite unusual because most of the famous grapes in the Barossa Valley are Shiraz, but there's this special block, and it's supposedly the longest producing block of Cabernet Sauvignon in the world. It was planted in 1888. So they're very old vines on a very special piece of ground, and the wine is quite a rare, precious wine. So I'd like you to taste the wine now, and I'll read out Peter Gago's description of the wine, because...
Could I mention some of the glass?
They're just on the side. They're just on the side if you want to collect one.
A spare one here, maybe.
Oh, okay. Okay. So this is how Peter describes the wine. It is densely coloured with intense aroma of blackcurrant, dark chocolate and licorice, and some malty vanilla new oak character. The palate is concentrated and fine silky tannins coat the mouth. The sheer volume and weight of fruit explodes in the mouth, giving tremendous depth and length of flavour. It is a powerful wine, beautifully balanced, and the finish is firm and long. A great vintage, the wine should last 40 to 50 years. You can buy this wine either in bottle or in a plumb bob. The plumb bob is a marriage of the art and science of winemaking, and I'll just talk briefly about the ampule project, which is what this is called. This and the box that it goes in were crafted by South Australian artisans. So the wine is contained in this ampule, and then it's encased in this plumb bob, and then there's a jarrah box that contains it. It's exactly the same wine that you can buy in bottle. But obviously in this creation of artistic presentation. When 2004 Block 42 first came out, you could buy it for about $450. It's around $800 now. And because it's virtual, I've been able to get an ampule for you to experience. And that cost $168,000. The 12 were made. One is held in the museum at Penfolds at McGill. The other 11 have been sold. So value adding, an example of value adding, and this is phenomenal. Climate change. Most scientists now believe that the conditions are getting hotter and drier, and that we have more frequent extreme weather events like heat waves. But first I'd just like to welcome you to the Waite campus. The Waite campus is home to the largest collection of agricultural scientists in the Southern Hemisphere. On this campus you have the University of Adelaide, CSIRO, Australian Wine Research Institute, SARDI, and a few other specialised groups. So it's a great collection of scientific minds here at the Waite. I'm going to talk a little bit about what happens when conditions get hotter and drier, but more particularly about when we have a heat wave. How do vines survive? The first thing they do is they increase their transpiration, and I'm going to talk about that in a moment. They increase their transpiration until the stomates close. So what does this mean? Water is crucial to the life of the vine. The vine sources its water from the roots, which is then moved up the trunk, the arms, the stem, to the leaf, and then through stomates, little openings called stomates, the water, a vapor, is evaporates into the atmosphere. And while those stomates are open, carbon dioxide can also come in. And the carbon dioxide is used in photosynthetic reactions. So it's critical that those stomates stay open for the process of photosynthesis. So what work has been going on here is to try and understand, and the experimental sites are up in the Barossa and the Riverland where it's warmer, to try and understand how you handle vines during a heat wave. And what they've essentially worked out is that you apply the water to fill the available soil water profile before the predicted heat wave, and then you water continually. And sometimes they call this pulse irrigation. They just keep putting little bits of water on regularly to keep that profile where most of the roots are hydrated or full of water so that you can have transpiration. This is a photograph taken by Professor Steve Timer, one of the authors of the Grapevine book, and these are the stomates. And they regulate the water loss from the vine by opening and closing. There's 100,000 of these stomates on an average size leaf. So there's a lot there. If the vine uses all the water and the leaf senses that, leaves can talk to roots and roots can talk to leaves. There's hormonal signals, and that's what some of the scientists are now investigating, those signals, how the vine can sense if the soil is drying out. But if these stomates close for an extended period of time, because transpiration also cools the leaf, if the stomates close and you have no transpiration, then the leaf heats up and desiccates and eventually would die. The other research program that's been happening is to try and understand, do some vines drink water more than others? And they do. Grenache has an ability to control its stomates much more than Shiraz. So when Grenache senses that the water supply is limiting, it will close its stomates. Shiraz, on the other hand, tends to keep its stomates open more widely and continues to transpire. Now, in vine physiology terms, we talk about Grenache being isohydric and Shiraz being anisohydric. But we can put it another way in layman's terms. Grenache is a pessimist. Grenache thinks that conditions are not going to get any better, closes up and conserves its water. Shiraz, on the other hand, is an optimist and keeps its stomates open, hoping that it's going to rain or that we will have irrigation supplied. The work that's happening here now is to try and find other varieties that behave like Grenache and that are more suitable for warmer, hotter climates. And some of those varieties obviously come from the hotter regions of Italy and Spain and the south of France. So one variety that's doing very well in several climates at the moment is Tempranillo, a variety from Spain. and it seems to behave similar to Grenache. Now, we've worked out how we can control transpiration by supplying water, and we can keep leaf function going. But once we come to berries, it's a much different situation. When you get direct sun on your berries, you can have shriveling and sunburn. And this is an example with white grapes. And it's quite obvious, you can see where you've had that intense sun on a section of the bunch. This also occurs with black grapes, but it's much harder to see the colour change with black grapes, but the shriveling effect is the same. And what happens when these grapes shrivel, plus get too high a temperature for aroma and flavour and tannin production, you get a very limited metabolism in the grape. So the colour is less and the flavour is less. But if they start to shrivel, and also if they get cooked, you get these cooked, raisiny, type of jammy type of characters, stewed plum type of characters, which is obviously detrimental when you pick the grapes and ferment them into wine, because you'll also see those characters in the wine. If you go up to the Barossa, the Riverland, or any of the warmer to hotter regions, you will see that most of the canopies have this umbrella effect. It's called the Australian sprawl, and there's a reason for it. The reason is that the leaves are well exposed for exposure to the light for photosynthesis and transpiration, but the bunches are hidden in under the shade, under the leaves, leaf coverage. So they get cooler and protected from the intense heat. What you have to be careful of is that if this canopy becomes too dense, then you get herbaceous and green flavours into the grapes and then into the wine. So we talk about getting canopies that provide dapple light, that are moderately open and where the light comes in and can just get onto to the grapes, but not in a direct function. The authors of the other book, a lot of this work that I'm talking about, we've written in this book, myself, Peter Dry again, he was one of Australia's top viticulturalists. Tony Proffitt is a consultant, was a student, works in WA now, and Steve Tyman. Steve Tyman is a professor of viticulture here in the School of Agriculture, Food and Wine. He is probably one of the top six plant physiologists in the world. He contributed a lot of the physiological science to the chapters in this book. But Steve loves working with gadgets, and he's developed this little microphone that he can attach to the petiole. The petiole is this section that goes from the stem to the leaf. And he can listen to the water going through that petiole. And when it stops or slows down, and the xylem vessels, because all the water is carried through this system in xylem vessels, when the xylem vessels, what we call cavitate, collapse, you get an acoustic signal. So the relevance of this is that it's a survival mechanism for the vine. We don't want it to happen, but if conditions get very severe, you will see that the petiole will detach and you lose the petiole and the leaf from the stem. But it's a survival mechanism in that the buds that will give you next year's growth are on the stem. So rather than the stem collapsing and falling off, it's better for the leaf to detach via the petiole from the stem, because you still maintain those buds for reproduction and new shoots for next year. So the vine's taking a short-term hit for long-term gain in terms of a survival mechanism. I'll talk a little bit about organic and biodynamic viticulture. And I put the University of Adelaide symbol there because some of the most comprehensive research on this topic is happening here. Our viticulture lecturer, Cassie Collins, and her team have set up experiments in McLaren Vale to compare what we call conventional, organic, and biodynamic viticulture. We can manage vines in three ways. I prefer to call it non-organic than conventional, because conventional varies. What's conventional to somebody is, you know, different to somebody else. So three ways: non-organic, organic, and biodynamic. What's the difference? The difference is that in non-organic, you can use manufactured fertilizers, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, and you can use synthetic sprays to control weeds, herbicides, sprays, and fungicide sprays to control diseases. In organic and biodynamic, you are not allowed to use those artificial inputs. There's a few other things that are a bit different, and when we get to biodynamics, we start to get this connection with the cosmos. Moving from non-organic to organic, organic viticulture tends to think of the vine as part of the ecosystem, what's happening below and above the ground in that environment around the vine. When you move to biodynamics, the circle gets much bigger and you go into the cosmos. And the biodynamic people believe that the life of the vine and the function of the vine are affected by the phases of the moon and the planetary movement. These are the people who are regarded as the fathers of organic biodynamic. We'll just talk about the gentleman on the left, Rudolf Steiner. He's regarded as the father of biodynamics. So biodynamics is this holistic approach based on the teachings of the Austrian philosopher Rudolf Steiner. He gave his first lectures in 1924. It's a holistic management system. It takes in the whole farm and also includes the farmer, the person in that. There's an emphasis on soil fertility, as there is in organic, and you have to consider the balance of the ecosystem and its connection to the cosmos. So you have to think of when you're going to do your sprays, when you apply compost, you have to know where the phases of the moon are and where they are in relation to the planets. These are the key inputs: an incorporation of compost to the soil, what we call spray 500, which is a horn manure, spray 501, which is a silica preparation, and then there's some other preparations. I just put this slide in to remind me to stress that there's other viticultural management practices like composting, mulching, and biodiversity that are very important in managing a vineyard. But tonight we're just going to concentrate on a few things. What is compost? Compost is where you mix two or more materials together, put them in a heap, heat them up, and they undergo this wonderful transformation to form compost. Why do we add compost? It's claimed, and there is experiments that have shown that you do get these effects, that you get enhanced natural chelation of the nutrients, so you get better nutrient uptake, you get much more biological activity in the soil, and you get enhanced root growth as a result of all that biological activity. These are some slides showing you how you make a compost. So pretty well, you start off with a pile of straw, then add some green material, and then you add a layer of fresh cow manure. And it's best, they say, if it's from a lactating cow. So then you continue this process of adding your straw, green material, your layer of fresh manure, and you pile it all up and leave it for 3 to 6 months, depending on how big it is and the temperature and how much you turn it. And this is what you end up with. The transformation to me, I do composting at home, and it's just amazing. You chuck all your kitchen scraps in and a bit of straw and that, and you end up with this earth. And a good compost does not smell. That's the secret. If you're doing it right, you can pick this up and it just smells like sweet earth. So that then is spread out in the vineyard and incorporated into the soil, either under the vine or along the vine rows. Compost can also be used in non-organic or conventional vineyards. A lot of people use composting mulching. This is where it gets a bit more challenging to accept biodynamics. The preparation of cow horn manure, you take fresh manure, put it into cow horns and bury it in the ground, and over winter, and then when you bring it up, you take a small portion of it, dissolve it in water, and then you're meant to mix it thoroughly by going one way and creating a vortex and then back the other way for an hour, 2 hours. It's to revitalize that compost. Now, this material, when it comes out, it's chock full of microorganisms. It's really goodies for the soil. But the question that scientists ask is, when you only add a very small amount and then spray it out over the vineyard, how much benefit do you really get? Biodynamic people believe that you really do get a big effect. Instead of mixing it by hand, most of the larger vineyards that are practicing biodynamics use this flow form, where it mixes one way in the top and the other way in the middle and then the other way in the bottom, so it gives you that mixing process. The second main preparation is silica 501, and that's crushed silica that is then put into the cow horns and buried over summer. The advantage, and it's also, when it's brought up, mixed using one of these flow forms. The advantages of using silica, it's claimed, is that it enhances photosynthesis, plus also strengthens the leaf so that it's more disease resistant. Then, and this becomes more challenging, you have these other preparations that are made from different flowers, and where you mix them up and you make solutions, and then you spray that out. Some of these are meant to be sprayed out when the moon is opposite Saturn, and or when it's got a certain alignment with Jupiter or these other planets. Now, how they've worked all that out, I'm not sure. But these preparations are meant to... people also put them into their compost when they're building their compost. And they're meant to vitalise the compost, or when you spray them out, they're meant to vitalise the soil and the plant. And these are the preparations, these natural flower preparations, that connect you to the cosmos. So beams of the moon and the natural flowers have this connection. Now, whether you can believe that or not, but remember I said leaves can talk to roots and roots can talk to leaves. So why can't a moon talk to a flower? I also need to emphasize that people don't only have these preparations that in biodynamics. There's a lot of other products that are allowed in organic and biodynamic viticulture, including copper and sulphur, and whey has been quite successful in controlling disease. The Biodynamic Association produced this calendar where you can see where the phase of the moon is, you can see where the planets are, and you can also see whether it's a particular day is a root day, a fruit day, or a flower day. And some people will only pick on a fruit day. And but that has the complication of the current weather conditions. If you're waiting for a fruit day and there's a heat wave, then you're more crazy than the biodynamic people. So, now, did anybody know when we had the last full moon? Last Monday. The moon was beautiful. So what I ask you to do is next month, find out when the next full moon, and just have a look at the full moon. And this is what people like about organic and biodynamics, is that you become much more connected to your environment and to the cosmos. And a lot of people follow it without believing in it, because it means you have to be out in your vineyard. People in conventional vineyards are out there also, but if you go to organic and biodynamic, you're required to be out there and understanding when to spray, etc. And people who are certified vineyards, biodynamic certified vineyards, don't have to follow all the biodynamic mechanisms or processes. You can, these are the main ones that you need to follow to get certified biodynamic. You do not use your artificial herbicides or fungicides. Use your compost and use those two preparations twice a year. You don't have to do things by the phases of the moon. You don't have to use all the other preparations. But the people who really do get involved in biodynamics do use all the other preparations. There's a lot of top wine companies practicing biodynamics. Cullen Vineyards in Western Australia, Gemtree. I'm not sure you buy so Gemtree and McLeanBowl, Castagna in Victoria, Cape Jaffa. Yeah, there's a lot of people have moved into organic. And in fact, you have to move into organic first and get through that process, and then you go into biodynamic. But a lot of people have moved into organic, and a few people have moved further into biodynamics, and a lot of them don't apply for certification because they're just trying it and experimenting. They're interested in it to see how it does work in their situation. This is a critical question, obviously. What happens to the taste of the wine, and what about the quality? Well, when we wrote the chapter, it's only just one page on these organic and biodynamic practices, but when we did that, I did a literature research and of the studies that have been done, and there's not many scientific studies. Most of the people who go into this are doing it for personal reasons. They feel that the use of chemicals is detrimental to Mother Earth. So, and I believe that too, that the more we cannot use chemicals, the better. But so there's not a lot of real strong science to test it. Here at the uni, there's a project where those three, conventional, organic and biodynamic, are being trialled. And in fact, in a couple of weeks' time is the main tasting. But so far, and also what the literature shows us, is that if you're managing your vineyard with excessive herbicides, excessive fungicide input, and poor viticulture, moving to organic and or just moving to compost and more sound viticultural practices can make a large difference. But if you've got a very good vineyard and you're doing all the right things, and particularly if you're using compost, mulching and biodiversity, cover crops in the mid-row, etc., there's not much improvement when you go to organic, or very little. The experiments have shown that there's no very little difference between them. And also the research has shown that going from organic to biodynamics has shown that there's very little benefits in going that extra path. So the people who choose to do it, it's a personal choice and an interest. And they do believe that it improves the quality of their food. The last wine that we have for tasting, and have you got that one? You didn't get any of it. Didn't get any. Could you give him yours? Yeah, thank you. So when we move to sweet fortified wines, and we're going to talk about Muscat, Rutherglen Muscat, the grapes get very ripe, and you pick those grapes, and when you have the ferment, you've got a mixture of turgid grapes and of raisin grape, and even some real raisins in there. And you ferment it just for a very short time, just as the ferment starts going, maybe only 2 days on skims. You then add alcohol, and that stops the fermentation. So you end up with a very sweet, fortified wine. I should have put that up. The sugar levels of these wines can be about 300 grams per litre. So they're very sweet, but they're also balanced with acidity, and the alcohol also contributes to the sensory sensation. So these wines then are stored in, they're pretty well fortified grape juice. We call them wines, but when you stop the ferment so early, there's a lot of sugar left there. They're then stored in these large oak barrels for many years, sometimes 50 years or more. So the wine that we're going to taste tonight is Chambers Rare Muscat. This, I should have mentioned, before bottling they will blend wines of different ages together. Some of the components in here would be 50 years or more. So we'll taste that wine now, and one thing that you may notice is that you get this khaki colour in fortified wines. It's a sign that the wine's been aged for a considerable amount of time. When you smell these wines, you've got the aromas of that come from the grape, but also that develop over many years being stored in those barrels. So you get this lovely walnut, treacle, raisiny character. But it's when you put these wines in your mouth that you really experience their sensory sensation, because they're so luscious, viscous, and you get those lovely characters coming through again, the treacle and raisin and coffees, and that there's a whole mixture. It's almost, you could describe it as a liquid fruitcake that you're tasting. You can, so while you're savouring that wine, I'll conclude on that, and I hope you've enjoyed the science, the stories, and the wine.
Experience, wasn't it? We weren't expecting that. But I'm sure some of you have some questions, and I know Patrick's willing to answer them. So, unfortunately, we don't have a roving mic tonight, but yes, so speak up.
Since I virtually bought two of those bottles of wine, I was just wondering how much I was going to have to pay for the last fortified wine.
The last fortified wine is for a 500ml bottle, will cost you about $250 to $300, and that's something that the Australian wine consumers don't really appreciate, the effort that goes into making these wines, storing them. They're very, very good value.
compared to some of the other guys that we've paid tonight.
Patrick, since this is a sort of subject of smell and how if you've been exposed to smells, maybe you lose the recognition. And I can think of examples, for instance, sometimes if we're walking into our winery and they say, oh, isn't that smell wonderful? Well, I don't notice that smell. I know when I was young walking into wineries, I know what they mean because I can remember as a young person smelling that. And I think maybe I was away for a long time when I walked into a winery and I had that experience. And I was wondering how that, I was also thinking of the example of champagne. When I smell champagnes now, and I love champagnes, and I find them very interesting, and certainly some of that yeast autolysis character that you described. But when I first came across, particularly French champagnes, the whole experience of the breadiness and the yeastiness was so rich and intense. Maybe I was, I don't know how old I was, maybe I was not a teenager, maybe I was 20 or so. But, the French champagne seemed like a whole complex separation from the equivalent Australian product. Australian product has probably improved a lot since that time. So do you think the same thing's happening, maybe I'm just losing my smell? Oh, maybe that's a simple explanation. But I'm wondering whether it's also maybe a factor of having smelt something and been exposed to it over a long period of time, in the initial period. So maybe then you become too familiar, and so therefore you don't recognize.
Yeah.
You think I'm losing my smell, or am I just overexposed?
Well, you start answer than I mean. As we do get older, our sensory abilities do decrease, both smell and taste.
Can you talk to that?
In wine tasting, you can get adapted to a smell, but that's more when like you're tasting a lot of wines in a short period of time. In your case, you're talking about losing a particular sense of smell totally, and so I don't know really the answer to the question. Maybe you should have a virtual winery and remember what the smells are like and experience them there. But I'm not sure. I'm finding it harder to describe the smells. And in fact, what I do now, and it was interesting, and I'm going to put this in the next book, that we're doing a book on Australian wine next year. But it was an article also that Max Allen, who's one of the wine writers, and he's skipping the look-smell part of the look-smell taste and just putting the wine in the mouth to get that total holistic experience. And I've been thinking of that for some time. And I've been using the look and the smell to see if the wine's faulty. Because once you put the wine in the mouth, with the warmth of the mouth, you can get the aromas much better. And if you think about it, when you go to a restaurant, you don't do the look. You might do it once, the look smell. But at a restaurant, then you just put the wine in your mouth, enjoy the food. So that connection, I thought of that connection with wine and food, but just the holistic experience. And I'm doing that more now. And skipping the first bits after I check if it's corked or not. But I don't have a good answer to you.
Two questions. With the watering of the vines, you mentioned the water coming up from the roots through the whole system. Now, is there no absorption through the leaf system downwards? That's the first question. And the second one is, if you're looking at this holistic idea, is there a time when the grapes are harvested that's better, a phase at the moment, perhaps when it's fallen earth or not?
The answer to your first question, if there is any movement back from the leaf, it's very small. But with berries, and Professor Steve Tyneman has been working on
berries because of, we want to try and understand the shriveling phenomenon. And berries shrivel because they transpire also. I didn't talk about that. But they transpire, but also when the vine gets stressed, you get what you call backflow. The vine can suck the water back out of the berry. So a berry shrivels when the backflow exceeds, you know, any the backflow exceeds the flow into the berry, the backflow and the transpiration. So for berries, yes, there's movement back into the stem or into the peduncle of the bunch. For leaves, I'm not sure of that. I think with leaves, the stomata tend to just block off and the leaf will desiccate. I'm not sure if any water is moved back. The best time to harvest the fruit is obviously when it's ready for a particular, the composition is ready for a particular style of wine. Now when we normally do that by taking samples of grapes, analysing for the sugar, the acidity, and both as titrate, acidity and pH, but most winemakers, viticulturists now, taste the grapes. And they have a lot of characters in the grapes that they look for, that when you chew the grapes, you know, what aroma sensations you get. They look at whether the seeds are brown and ripen, and whether they're cracking or soft, and whether the skin is chewy or not. That's how, you know, most people do it. Now, biodynamic people also do that, but they then believe that if they wait for a fruit day, that the metabolism of the berry is enhanced and you get a little bit extra. But I can't explain that.
In the tasting or the drinking of wine, particularly red wine, how beneficial is it to decant it from a bottle or taste it? Is there any difference?
The benefits of, the main benefit of decanting is to remove it from any deposit. Our advice that we talk about in the book is that you open the bottle just before you're going to drink it. And then you decant it if it's got any deposits. You decant it and then you pour the wine into your glass. And the mechanism of swirling the glass will get rid of any kind of storage bottle characters, but we aerate it sufficiently to modify the aroma and tannin slightly. So you get much better enjoyment doing that if you decant it and then serve it. Try it, and then try it after swirling it a few times while you're enjoying it. If you decant it and leave it in the decanter, as some people suggest, overnight or for 4 hours, 3 hours, you're taking the chance that you'll miss some of the characters that were there. And the only people who can thoughtfully decant are if you have a lot of experience with a certain wine style. So if you're a sommelier in a, you know, restaurant and you've served that wine many times and decanted it, you will know purely by experiment that it can handle 3 hours of decanting. But if it's as an individual, if you're enjoying it just yourself, decant it at the spot deposit and then pour it in and use that swirling to then see what do you think? And modifies the characters.
One more question at the back, and then I think we need to finish.
You said a lot about the differences in the cultivation between the three methods, but I'm just interested in whether you've got any comment on whether they
have different approaches to additives, like preservatives.
Inorganic and biodynamic winemaking, there is restrictions on adding certain compounds, but the normal things like acid and sulfur dioxide, you can add, but the levels that you're allowed to add are much lower than in conventional. I think it's is it 250 milligrams per litre total SO2 in a normal wine, and I think a biodynamic, the regulation is about half that. I'm not sure. Do you know that any? So, but the additions of sulfur dioxide are much lower, and they can't add any manufactured fining agents and things like that. They have to be natural fining agents.
I wouldn't have thought that the differences in the end wines were very significant. These days, total sulfur in reds tends to be 80 to 100 yeah. parts per million. And total quantities in whites tends to be 120 to 160
yeah.
parts per million, and it's probably in both treatments.
Yeah, that's
always, of course, being more sulfur in white than there is in red.
Yeah, that's a good point. Even though the legal requirements might be set, as Mark said, in a lot of Australian wines, the levels are much lower than the regulatory. So yeah, there wouldn't probably be a lot of difference between SO2 inorganic and biodynamic compared to conventional.
Well, I'm sure we'll never drink another glass of wine the way we've been drinking it tonight out there. We'll be much more thinking about what we've been told and being able to really enjoy it better for the experience that we've had through Patrick tonight. I'd also like to thank Patrick's wife, Judy. Where are you, Judith, for coming along tonight? Because Judith is part of the partnership of the publishing company and obviously great supporter of Patrick in his work. And Judith has brought quite a lot of books that she'd love to sell to you. So after this, if you've got the chance, please go out and talk to Judith and Patrick. And if you are able to, buy a book, and Patrick will even sign it for you. So it will be part of the experience. I'm sorry that we weren't able to have a real experience with drinking Patrick's wine. It would have been something, wouldn't it, to have drunk some of those wines. But it's something we can take away with us tonight to think about. And I think what Patrick says, that one of the things he said is we don't realise the amount of work and complexity that goes into making this wine, and how can we buy a bottle, you know, $20, and think that's a fantastic wine when there's more expensive ones, you know, what there are so much more complex and much more history and much more of world experience has gone into making that wine. Mm. So on your behalf, I'd like to present Patrick with a little gift from the Friends of the Library. He gets a book voucher from our sponsor, Uni Books, which he can go and spend. Maybe he'll be wanting to buy something that's not to do with wine. He's probably interested in nothing. And a set of our gift cards, our wonderful gift cards that he can use. And so we'd like to thank him again. And on your behalf, we'd like to...